What in God's Name is in Summer Replay. This show was released from around the presidential election, November 19th, 2020. The title, What If We Don't Want to Heal? Shana and I will be back with a new show starting season 4 of What in God's Name on September 2nd. Do you know what the fish said when he ran into the concrete wall?
Oh, God. What?
Damn.
So bad. Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
She is Shana Appel.
We are the podcast that attempts to get beyond the binary of political and the economic, which colors so much of the conversation taking place in our public square these days.
It is the metaphor of vision to see more clearly, for things to be revealed. We use theology and philosophy to see more clearly and to reveal those things that are hidden when we just use the usual lenses of politics and economics. People pick up our show at different times. You might be listening to this episode, and it might be your very first What in God's Name. So we like to say to those of you who might be picking up this episode as your first What in God's Name, we say to you, welcome.
Welcome.
And as Shana says, we keep it to 23 and a half minutes.
23 and a half minutes.
Give or take 12 seconds either way. And we do like to keep it a little bit light. And one way that we keep it a little bit light is our spinny wheel, which, if you can think of the wheel of fortune, a wheel that spins around, we have a sprinkler head as the pointer, and the wheel can land on any one of 16
duct taped to a bicycle wheel with a playing card, you know, just so that we can all remember our childhood when we used to put playing cards in the spokes of our tires, because Chris apparently had a little too much time on his hands, and so here we are.
And we will post today's spinny wheel on Facebook. Don't spin it yet, Shana, because I'm gonna video this with the iPhone. The spinny wheel can land on one of 16 different categories, and they're just little concepts, little tidbits, little core values that we have, and we do a little riff on whichever one the spinny wheel lands on. Shana, go ahead and give that thing a spin. The spinny wheel has landed on citizenship, which will be very good for today's show. Part of what we lift up on our podcast, What in God's Name, is citizenship, thinking about the ways that we need to form ourselves, develop the habits of citizenship, ways of interacting with one another, ways of being engaged in the world, hopefully deeper than political ways of engaging, so that we can be self-governing and together and unified.
And life has a way of developing, and society has a way of developing in such a way that we are constantly being called forward, right? We're constantly being called to expand that notion and figure out new ways of living together. So there's the challenge, citizens.
As we do our theological analysis of what is going on in the United States, we do have allies in that. And one of our allies is America Magazine. America Magazine is the journal of the Order of the Jesuits, the Roman Catholic Order of the Jesuits in the United States. And our jumping off point today is an article by Bill McCormick entitled, Joe Biden Said Now is Time to Heal, But What If Americans Don't Want Reconciliation? Bill McCormick in the article does a great job analyzing what reconciliation means and different facets of reconciliation. And Shana and I are going to take one of those elements of reconciliation because it's really insightful and it helps, at least for me, Shana, it helps name internal tension that I have as I think about our society and our common life in these days post-election.
And Chris, let's be honest, sometimes it's just fun to come from the place of our own confusion. So healing and reconciliation. Do Americans have any appetite for reconciliation after this year's tense election season? And should they? That's the opening question. And boy, did that one catch my attention. The bottom line is that, you know, McCormick is observing that reconciliation may not even be desirable if the cost is too high. And I think when he's referring to the cost, he's referring to what it would cost truth, what it would cost, you know, our souls to try to come back to center with an administration that is sinful.
That's the language he uses, definitely. And again, he's not saying, he's just lifting this up as one possible way to understand the cost of reconciliation.
Yeah. And I think it was Matthew Sittman who said that the administration is sinful and those who supported it are complicit.
Right. Reconciliation, from that perspective, involves those who are distant from the truth about what is good to come to some recognition of how distant they are from the truth. And therefore, the process is one of recovering the truth and then repenting, turning towards that truth. And so he contrasts that with a different view of reconciliation, which is one that I've lifted up and we've lifted up several times, which has more to do with sympathy and listening empathically to the other, having bonds of affection, which we've had shows about. And so this is the tension. On the one hand, reconciliation understood as this kind of sympathetic listening, seeking understanding of what the other person is saying, that flavor of reconciliation versus something I'm going to characterize as, this isn't his word, but it's mine, something a little bit harder, which is confronting the truth. And so it's a stance of, in a way, I characterize it as having conviction. Like when we see things that are wrong, it doesn't do, it's not good enough to try to sympathize necessarily with what's wrong, but rather to confront it.
So let me just say that I think McCormick, maybe, or I'm wondering, let me say, I don't think, I'm wondering if he hasn't created something that is diametrically opposed where maybe it's not. Just because I allow another's reasoning to live in my landscape such that I now understand where they're coming from and taking this asshole position that they've taken doesn't mean I agree with them, right? So, and that's Henry Nelson Wyman, right? That's creative interchange. I create space within me for another's truth to exist so that I understand where they're coming from. That doesn't necessarily have to change my notion of the truth. So, for example, I believe truth is on the side of putting children in cages is just wrong. That there is never a reason. There is no excuse. It is an abomination unto the Lord. And it is sinful as hell. And that is not even, I mean, it is just pure evil. That's what I believe, okay? So now I'm going to talk to somebody who has reason to believe, well, you know, they bring these kids in here illegally, and some of them are being brought in by people who aren't even their parents. Okay, none of that is selling me. That is a surface argument as far as I'm concerned. And what I would need to do, a la Wyman, is to go deep with this person and find out what is it that is being challenged. What are they afraid of losing? Because that's probably right. There's some fear down there at the bottom that if that justifies this horrific behavior. And until I get to that piece and they know that they've been heard, I don't think they're going to have any interest in listening to, you know, what an abomination their position is. You know, I understand that you've been struggling, your whole family is unemployed, all of these people are coming in, and you are thinking that this is going to take more food off your table, which you don't have to give, and you feel disenfranchised and powerless, and now all of these people are coming in. So that is pretty terrifying, and I can understand your anger now. Can you please try just try to hear me out on this one. Is there any world in which you can believe that God would affirm, that Jesus Christ would affirm this behavior? So maybe McCormick has created a dichotomy where there isn't one. On the other hand, having listened to what I just said, that could all be utter BS and, you know, rainbows and unicorns and forget it. These people aren't going to listen. They don't care. And they are an abomination. Hard to tell because we haven't, there doesn't even seem to be a space or a way to even begin the conversation, to find out.
I think you've characterized it so beautifully. What a great example. And you've lifted up the tension. And I think you're right. I think in this sense, if I've heard you correctly, in the real world, as we are human beings engaging with other human beings, we have to hold, if we're mature people, both things at the same time. Our commitment to what is right and our commitment to stay connected with those others with whom we disagree, somehow stay connected to them so that we can hear them. And also, we may be convicted of the truth and the right in instance X, Y, and Z. In all those instances, correct, time will tell. But in situation A and B, we may be convinced of our rightness and that it's the truth. And we may be mistaken because we're fallible human beings.
Which is what one of the people he interviewed, who interestingly is just listed as a comedian and I don't know him, but that was his point, right? He said that people seek good or what they think is good. So we can always make a case on their behalf. In other words, they don't desire evil, but may seek the good in a way that's misinformed or disordered. In the process of pursuing truth, we have to wrestle with the tyranny of relativism. It feels to me like in postmodernity, truth went out the window. There is no longer any truth. Rocks are hard. Water is wet. That is a truth. And if you disagree with me, then it may be that you need to see somebody who can help you get back into reality, because it's just what's so. Now, when we get into the issue of children in cages, in my worldview, that's just wrong, and that's just what so. So I don't know what your thoughts are on how that impacts this whole process.
It surely affects the process, because all of these conversations occur in a space where the metaphysical infrastructure has been eroded. What I mean by that is relativism erodes the moral space in which we can even begin to have conversations. If there's no truth, then purple is green and it's Alice in Wonderland, which I said last week.
Right.
Yeah. So,
and I was thinking about that as I read the article, because it's impossible to do a process of reconciliation if there's no agreement on truth. So, in terms of fundamental truths, and we are in a post-truth, we are in, God, some days I feel like Alice through the looking glass.
I wonder what you think about this, what I want to say. I wonder about thinking about this on two different levels and telling almost two different kinds of stories. At one level, which is where we started, the hypothetical one-on-one conversation with another person right in front of you. You outlined how that might go and how you would hold both to a conviction about what is good and true at the same time as listening sympathetically. And that's a story, I think that's a story of healing to me, if that's possible, to hold on to both of those in the one-on-one, person-to-person conversation. There's a lot of caveats to go with that, which is, when do those conversations happen, for example? But leave that aside for a second and just think about that interaction, the one-on-one element. And that's one story. The other story is then the story that we tell ourselves about our common life writ large. And what is the story there? is it a story of division so great that there's no way to bridge them? I think we can lose sight of what's really happening if we just deal in aggregates.
I agree, and I think what you're saying is so brilliant because you're lifting up the context in which the conversation has to happen. And the context, of course, is a common narrative. And the narrative can be aspirational, which I think the United States is an aspirational idea. But there has to be some agreement about what the common narrative is or what the common aspiration is. And so if there's not that, and we've talked about this before, that language of a common lot, of a shared interest in that conversation left the building after World War II. We don't have leaders who, I mean, our leadership is not united. Our leadership is so divided and that it has become divisive. And so now I go back to something that you always say, politics is downstream of culture. And I feel like, you know, what you said last week was absolutely right, that we're going to need a cultural revolution. And the cultural revolution is that we, the people, start telling a different story. And I don't know how you do that beyond the one-on-one. That, you know, reaching out to the people who you have differences with and trying to find some commonality. However, even as I say that, I was talking to a member of my congregation whose family system is way out in right field from where she is. And said, well, you know, there's got to be something you can find commonality in. And so, you know, she went out and she tried and came back and said, you know, couldn't do it. The thing I know about the conversations between people across those differences is that it requires actual training. I know that my training as a marriage and family therapist comes in handy there. I know all of my training in pastoral care, you know, as a minister comes in handy there. And more importantly, then even all of that is the nonviolence de-escalation training that I've been doing since, you know, 1979, 1980. And my years as a paramedic, right? How do you not get sucked up in the chaos that's going on and stay focused on your objective? All of those things are what help me get there. And I guess my question to our listeners today is, what helps you? And I think if you begin to delve into some of that material, you start to understand what will be required. You know, for it is not going to be easy. I mean, I think there is a reason that in Christianity we talk about the need for all of us to bear our cross. And collectively, as a nation right now, that cross is freaking weighty. And it is the cross of divisiveness, of casting one another out with absolutely no intention of bringing one another back in. So there, take that and run with it.
One of the beautiful things about what you were enumerating there about skills is those are the skills of citizenship. Back to the spinny wheel, the all-knowing spinny wheel. Those are the habits of mind. Those are the skills, the things we learn that help us to be. It helps families to talk. I mean, in some ways, we're a dysfunctional family, writ large.
Well, because we don't talk about citizenship anymore.
Right, exactly.
We don't talk about citizenship.
And how to do it.
We don't talk about a common lot. We don't talk about that. We've been so damn divided for so long. There is a lot of work for all of us to do. And I think sometimes doing our own work is what softens us up a little bit to helping other people do theirs. Because, you know, we start to realize how difficult this is.
The other things I wanted to react to in what you were saying is that there's an opportunity for faith communities here. Your observation that we don't have political leadership that's telling a story that we can tell together, that is so. So where's the story going to come from? Those of us in faith communities have ready-made stories that need to be translated into a plural society. Like, we can't just tell the specialized story of Jesus that we tell to other Christians. It has to be a bigger story about the common good.
It goes back to what you're saying, a common narrative, a desire. We have to at least all have a desire to get along. And listening the other day to a nurse who was being interviewed talking about people who come in gasping for breath, are diagnosed with COVID, don't believe it because COVID is BS. They don't have COVID. This is just the flu, which, and now they're pissed, right? But still in their anger, unwilling to concede that this is COVID and that they're about to die. You know, and the medical staff is watching their O2 sats drop. They know where this is going. They're asking, you know, do you want to reach out to your family? Do you want? No, because they're too busy being angry and this is how they're going to die. That is a reality of the culture we live in right now. And I don't know that that can be bridged. However, that is also not the whole of our culture. And it may be that for the time being, we take that chunk of people who are so disengaged from reality and hold them in our thoughts and hold them in our prayers. But maybe that's not the group we start engaging with. Find some people who are a little bit closer to the center, you know, with whom you can find some commonality and begin a conversation.
My takeaway today, Shana, is my self-reflection on this question. And there are times when I have a hard heart and I'm angry. And that's partially due to my own personal story, like lies and confusion. It makes me despondent, makes me sad. And I get angry then as a defense against my set. And that makes my hard heart, my heart hard. That makes my...
It does. It makes your hard heart harder.
Hard heart harder. And then I also can get to a place, because of my pastoral work and pastoral training, where my heart softens. And it softens because I know, as do you, that everybody is walking around with a great burden. Everybody is carrying a lot of pain. That helps my heart get softer. And that's a place where I live better. But it's hard.
It's hard.
Everybody knows. Everybody has said the election, it's not the end. It's the beginning of hard work. And
yes.
So that's my takeaway for today. That's where my hard work is.
And I'm with you in part in that, you know, when I read the article, I was like, which side of the fence am I on? The side that wants to judge or the side that wants to make reconciliation? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized I was in both camps, you know, in that I do believe that for the time being, there needs to be a time and a place where we say to someone, okay, I can't deal with you right now. You know, maybe somebody who's better at this can deal with you, but I can't. And the truth that your truth is absolutely positively wrong. Like, yeah, I'm arrogant enough to say that in certain situations. So I'm a both and, because I also do. I mean, I want to heal. I don't want to live in this world the way it is right now. It sucks. I don't want to live with all this anger and families. I mean, families are... The best thing that could happen at Thanksgiving is COVID-19, so people don't actually have to get around a big old table and duke it out with Uncle Bob. You know, for me, it's a both and, Chris. Chris is hysterical over there.
I love duking it out with Uncle Bob.
My takeaway is that it's a both and. And, you know, again, the writer of Ecclesiastes nailed it, you know, when they said, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. The writer did not say a time for judgment and a time for reconciliation, but I will add that to the list.
Duking it out with Uncle Bob might be the title of the show. You might see that tomorrow on the...
Excellent.
Yep. Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by Patreon, our supporters on Patreon, and also our supporters on Filmmakers Collaborative. We'd like to ask you to help the algorithms show us to others. Help those pesky little algorithms. On Facebook, go to our Facebook page, at What in Gods, and like. Hit the like button on that. That helps the algorithms find us. And also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Your civic duty is to lift up actual and real and healthy conversation. So I'm guilting our listeners into going to Facebook and to Apple Podcasts to help the algorithms lift up this actual and real and healthy conversation about our common life. Get on our email list by going to our website, That's whatingods.com.
WHATINGODS.
Great to see you, Shana.
Great as always to see you, Chris.